You're listening to a podcast from the Media Motel.
Coming up this week in episode 311, can we afford to house everyone? Can we afford not to? The post-election fallout continues and it's exam time. We look back at our own ups and downs in the classroom. That's all coming up after The Clash and London Calling. Somehow feels appropriate for this week. The Clash from 1979 and London Calling. Welcome to the award-winning, I assume, podcast.
If not now, then surely in the future.
Exactly. Podcast from the Parish Council. We've reached episode 311.
No one's intervened, have they? Still, we are still continuing unhindered.
No one's told us to stop. We may as well, you know, just keep going, I guess. I'm Terence Stackham, and right over there it's, oh, Julian Harris. Whoa, Julian Harris.
And, you know, we are all great. Those of us, I was talking to my friends about this the other day, those of us that have three-syllable forenames and, oh, sorry, that's my alarm telling me that I need to get upstairs with you. There we go. But those of us that have three-syllable forenames and two-syllable surnames are living in a golden age now that our names fit to the Jeremy Corbyn chant.
Absolutely. I kind of think he followed you on this. I assumed that as you sort of walked into your office every day that, you know, this was how your day began with people.
Well, I was I was greeted by a colleague as this the other day, which did make me chuckle a great deal, I must admit. Yes, oh well. We could talk a lot about how I feel that having a football chance a political leader doesn't necessarily demonstrate that we're in a healthy place. But anyway, let's move on.
Okay. Well, Jules, we've started several podcasts so far this summer with words along the lines of following the terrible events
week. I know. What a year we've had. It felt like it started with the terribly untimely death of Joe Cox, which was a year ago yesterday, I think. There are lots of great get-together events going on this weekend, which is great. But it seemed like that was the start of a sort of a complete nightmare, really.
And sadly, this week, in June 2017, for those listening in the future, it's yet another. This time it's London again as the focus after a terrible, dreadful fire in a tower block in West London. And now, actually, many of the tower blocks around the Kensington and Notting Hill area are well known to me, as I was involved in pirate radio in the 1970s and 80s in London. And we used those tower blocks to hold our aerials and transmitters. I'm fairly sure I've been up that Grenfell Tower. But the thing is, they were grim and rather awful places in the 1980s, so heaven knows what a state they're in now. I haven't been in them for some years, obviously. But what this appalling tragedy has highlighted is the incredible distance in terms of conditions between housing for those who are personally very rich and those who rely on social housing. And the distance between them in West London is only a few yards, but the distance or difference in terms of living conditions is galaxies wide.
Absolutely, yeah, no, I completely agree. And it's interesting, with what appears now to be weird foresight, a journalist that I know personally called Cole Morton, who is a sort of radio and newspaper journalist, wrote a story about this in The Independent in 2013, I think, where he did a sort of a walk around and made exactly those points. And he was accompanied by one of the few Labour councillors for the area, a woman called Emma Dent Code. If we flash forward now, Labour unexpectedly won Kensington by 20 votes two weeks ago now, and Emma Dent Code is now the MP. All I can say is what a first week she's had in post, I must admit. It's a totally weird one. The block of flats, and you know, it's a story which the more you learn about it, the crosser that you get about it, really, and weirdly, I don't know if this was pre-block or around the time the block was built, but my mother comes from that area of West London. She comes from Shepherd's Bush. But the thing that you forget about, like you say, about West London is that, you know, Shepherd's Bush and Notting Hill are very close to each other, and Kensington and Chelsea, and you've got all these very rich and very poor places all kind of weirdly muddled up in one. And my mum said, and then she said afterwards, oh God, I feel terrible saying this, but I suppose it is useful as way of colour, that when she was a kid, so she would have been, I think they left London in 58 or 59, I think. So this would have been late 50s when my mum was about 4 or 5. She was discouraged by her mother and grandmother from playing with the Grenfell Road kids because they were seen as quote-unquote common. So it was always a rough area even then, I suppose. And like you say, it doesn't sound like it's got any less rough, although having said that, you know, there are thriving, I think what this has proved, that there is a thriving community there, because of course the way that the community has rushed to come together in the aftermath of this terrible disaster, I think shows that it's not necessarily to be written off. But the more you learn about the details of it, I mean, the idea that, so as Polly Toynbee put it rather sadly in The Guardian, this is a little bit like an unhappy version of, you know, when we have the Olympics and Britain do well in a sport and we all become experts on a very technical aspect of that sport overnight. So I remember Britain were denied a silver medal in the gymnastics in 2012, and all of us was an expert in a technical dismounts overnight. We all became very into that. Well, now, rather unhappily, we are all experts in cladding, aren't we? That's become the sort of the story. And the idea that there are two types of cladding, and one was £22 a metre and one was £24 a metre, and the slightly less expensive one was less good in terms of whether or not it was flammable, and that was the one that was picked because it was cheap. So for the want of £5,000, perhaps this could have been avoided. I mean, the idea that, you know, materials for housing, you can have a flammable and a non-flammable option. I mean, surely there should just be one option, it's which insane, is non-flammable. Why are we, you know, how are we here, really? And I suppose, in a way, it just exposes the kind of property divide, really. And as a lawyer that works in the property sector, I don't do housing law in the sense that I don't do tenancies and that sort of thing. But again, I can make the comment that I would have wanted to have specialised in housing law once upon a time. I probably would have ended up doing that and, you know, helping people that very much live on the bottom rungs and helping them have secure rents and secure tenancies. But thanks to the demise of legal aid and the destruction of legal aid, frankly, and that's you know, by various governments. Unfortunately, I can't exempt the last Labour government from that. But, you know, the various governments kicking that apart, you know, there aren't lawyers like me that are around to help these people, really. So I can only talk about it from a property values perspective, which is that, you know, some of the most expensive property in the entire country surrounds this block, in which I don't think anybody probably owned their own flat in that block. I think everybody probably rented, and as a result of which are treated with contempt, frankly. And that makes me so beyond angry, really. And you know, there's such a divide now between people that own and people that rent properties, at the point where, according to some polling I saw the other day, people that they had people that lived in the private rented sector and people that live in their own houses, you know, that are owner occupied. I didn't see any figures for social housing, by the way, which is in between. But in terms of who voted Labour or Conservative, the figures switched each way, so literally exactly the opposite. So it was something like 51-32 Conservative Labour for people that own their own properties, and then the other way around for privately rented. And that surely shows the complete divide. I mean, we live in such a divided society, but property is surely an example of that.
Yeah, I think it's been in successive governments' interest to ignore the horrific and alarming conditions in which some live. And I think the reason is that they, if they confront it, then alternative proper housing has to be found. And that costs money, so politicians look the other way. Both parties, including indeed in the coalition, so three parties. And only a few miles from where I'm sitting now, in the Hounslow, Heston, Ealing areas of West London, there's a really underreported situation of what's, you know, it's a sort of media term, but beds in sheds. And this is sometimes four people living in literally a garden shed and paying about £500 a month just for that mattress in an uninsulated, essentially it's a wooden box. And almost nothing is being done about it. Two reasons. One I've given is that local authorities who shut these places down would need to find alternative accommodation for the people in the sheds. And the second reason is that local authorities are terrified of being labelled racist, and so they cannot confront this situation. So many of those involved in West London overcrowding and the beds in sheds, they just rake in thousands of pounds a month, cash in hand, of course, by exploiting vulnerable people and putting their safety at risk. But there's just one thing you said a minute ago. I just wanted to kind of challenge you on, really, because it's something that we talked about when we had the...
It's been a while since we've had one of these rounds, so let's carry on.
When we had the terrorist atrocities a couple of weeks ago, and this came up again, it really does chime a very bad chord with me when I keep reading about and hearing that the Queen does this, Mrs. May does this, talking about the community coming together. I continue to see this as a mask that hides the reality. The reality is people have got a right to be angry. It's lovely that people do this, you know, work and sort of turn up at these places with clothing and food and so on. And it does display a decent part of the sort of British way of life. However, it seems to me that politicians in particular like to put the focus on that rather than fixing the terrible situation that occurred. And it's all too easy to say, oh, yes, you know, it's a terrible tragedy, but, oh, look at these people coming along with their blankets and their loaves of bread. That's not the story. The story is the terrible conditions in which these people were forced to live and were ignored. And I fear that will get brushed aside because we'll all see, you know, front page pictures of people handing in, you know, Marks and Spencer's food and coats and whatnot.
Well, okay, so two things to pick up on that. One, I'm far more inclined to agree with you on this than I was on the terrorism thing, because there is a difference between these two situations in that the government is the actor here. Mm. But in the situation with the terrorism, this is, you know, this is a separate malign force of people. So in this case, there is a direct correlation between the actions of the government, both at local level. I mean, Kensington and Chelsea, the council, could not have handled this any worse, really. I mean, there are so many issues with their disaster response here. We could probably spend another hour talking about it, really. We'd get to the end of my voice and beyond talking about that, I would think. But in this case, there is a direct correlation between, you know, David Cameron's ill-advised statement in 2012 that he wanted to rid the world of red tape and health and safety. Yes, thank you for that. That's certainly, like all of David Cameron's decisions, that's turned out well in retrospect, hasn't it? So I have more of a, you know, far more agreement with you on that point. However, what I would say is, in terms of people coming together, yes, that is really good. I agree that doesn't take away from the story, but this is an ever-evolving story. I don't want to use the expression grief rainbow, but you see what I mean. It's a kind of a, you know, that was the most helpful thing people could do in the immediate aftermath to, you know, to try and at least get out of the immediate situation they found themselves in. However, I think now is the time to say, well, look, now that we've managed to, you know, sort, and actually, and we'll talk, I think, later in the podcast about Theresa May and the situation that we're in nationally, but I think the explosion of anger at her on Friday afternoon, and actually Emily Maitlis's phenomenal interview with her on Newsnight on Friday. I mean, I've never, ever heard Emily Maitlis that angry or that emotional, which I think just goes to show where we are now, is that, you know, the time for anger is now, because it's taken 3 days for the government to sort themselves out and 3 days for the government to offer any kind of significant response to this. So, yes, I do think it's positive that the community have come together. And I think that should only be treated in the immediate aftermath. That should only be treated as positively. But now that's happened and we're 3 days in, now is the time for fury, I think. So don't think that people aren't cross, because they are. It's just that, obviously, I think there is a time at which that anger should be deployed.
Mm. Speaking of Mrs. May, we're back looking at the post-election fallout, week two, right after Lord.
Wait till you're announced. We've not yet lost all our graces. The hounds will stay in chains. Look upon your greatness and she'll send the call out, 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 send. Dance and tell.
We live in cities you'll never see on screen. Not very pretty, but we sure know how to run things. Living in ruins of a palace within my dreams. And you know we're on each other's team. I'm kinda over getting told to throw my hands up in the air. So there.
this is my attempt to be sort of positive in the aftermath of everything that's happening. We're all inside this team. I love Lorde. I think she's great. She's got a new album out, apparently, which I haven't listened to yet. I think we've played Royals on the podcast before because I absolutely love that. And Team was the follow-up, and I didn't think that anything could be as good as Royals, but actually that's great, and I quite like it as a sort of a positive. If I had teenage kids and was trying to manipulate the music they were listening to, I would try and get them to listen to positive stuff like this, I think.
She's got a lovely voice.
Such poise for someone so young as well.
Yeah, she's still only about 20, I think, isn't she?
I know, she was about 16 or 17 when Royals and Team came out, and you just think, oh my goodness, you know, so much ahead of her, I hope.
Ever since June the 8th, I've sensed a feeling, a mood of change in the country. I may be imagining it, I'm sure you'll tell me, but I think it's there. Even the Daily Mail has published stories critical of the Prime Minister, but rather tellingly reporting reasonably positive news about Mr. Corbyn, unthinkable 2 weeks ago. Much of the post-election analysis continues to focus on the roles of Theresa May's two close advisers, Nick Timothy and Fiona Hill. And Mr. Timothy seems to have become a centre of interest at The Spectator magazine, where this week associate editor Toby Young, with, I have to say, astonishing loyalty, describes Nick Timothy as, and I quote, a Tory visionary. He deserves a second chance. Nick's vision could help heal the schisms exposed by the EU referendum. British politics needs people as thoughtful and talented as Nick. And you have to admire that level of friendship or loyalty. Also in The Spectator, Nick Timothy himself has written a column, both regretful but also defending his position. However, Jules, in the midst of Nick Timothy's Spectator epistle is a rather throwaway line that I'm intent of retrieving and placing before you. Mrs. May's closest aide in relation to setting their election campaign strategy says, again a quote, Theresa, never comfortable in the limelight. Now, I'm very understanding of anyone who may feel anxious appearing in public outside their comfort zone, but in which case, if she's never comfortable in the limelight, don't try to become Prime Minister of the United Kingdom.
Well, and this is it, isn't it, really? And I read a very interesting piece in the Evening Standard that was published on Friday that was a kind of a dissection of the election campaign and what went wrong. I have a pal called Tom Hamilton, who was a senior figure in Labour in 2015. He was director of Rebuttal, I think, or he was certainly very high up in terms of working with Ed Miliband in the 2015 campaign. I met him on that campaign, actually. I would entirely recommend following him on Twitter. He is extremely funny and extremely insightful. And he tweeted in response to this article, list of people who the election loss was not their fault. And basically he went down this and he got to about 12 or 13, I think. And basically this article read like you would expect an article in George Osborne's Standard to read, really, which was basically kind of everyone pointing fingers at everyone else, and the blame was squarely dumped on Nick Timothy and Fiona Hill, particularly on Fiona Hill, actually, because they pointed out, and I agree with you, Theresa May has never been a spotlight person. She's always been a grafter, which was why I was surprised that the campaign took the turn it did in terms of a presidential campaign, because I thought she would be shown as a grafter and that her colleagues would be used as a kind of, you know, she'd be the head grafter in charge of a cabinet, which has some talent in it. And you know, we will go on to talk about why I'm surprised that other certain people weren't used. So apparently Fiona Hill and Nick Timothy are hyperly loyal to Theresa May, sort of insanely loyal. And there are rumours, some Tory MPs are convinced that she is still in touch with them, by the way, but still.
I wouldn't be surprised at all.
Yeah, absolutely, but yeah. So Fiona Hill had this habit of, so people might know they're listening, that most campaigns run to a grid. This was a kind of an innovation that was borrowed primarily from Labour, by Labour from the Democrats in the early 90s. And the idea is you have a grid, so you have a campaign grid, and you know what's going to happen each day, what appearances there are around the country, who's going to go where. Because the idea is if you've got a cabinet full of people, then, you know, you'll send some of them off to do regional appearances. It reminds people in regions that they are still cared about, that, you know, that it's not just the Prime Minister, there's a whole lot of you, and different people should be good at different areas. So, for example, Boris Johnson was to be deployed to the southwest because that's Leave territory, and, you know, like it or not, him and the bus, he was on that team, and you'd expect, you know, perhaps Northern MPs to be sent to other places, perhaps Stephen Crabb in Wales, you know, that sort of thing. Fiona Hill had a habit of going down the grid and taking people out of it. And it would seem that there were people that she felt were a threat to Theresa May, I think, were taken out of it. So we saw very little of Justine Greening. We did see quite a lot of Amber Rudd, to be fair, but we saw very little in the way of Andrew Leveson. And we've talked about this, and Philip Hammond, and our slightly differing views on Philip Hammond, but apparently it became a sort of a party game, really, that the people writing the grid and the strategists were put Philip Hammond in every day to see if they could get away with having him speak at places, and every time Fiona Hill took him out. And as someone put it, they were desperately trying to run on a basis that Labour would be very chaotic at the economy and that the Tories were the safe choice, yet it's difficult to make that argument if your Chancellor is not allowed to appear in public. And that's where we found ourselves, really. And actually, they played into Labour's hands, and that Labour did actually a surprisingly good job of rebutting the idea from the Tories that they were, you know, difficult at spend, or rather too easy at spending, by costing their whole manifesto when the Tories didn't. And you might argue that the costings were a bit wonky in places, but, you know, they did at least try.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then you've got the Tories with an uncosted manifesto, and a Chancellor is not allowed to speak in public. And the blame in this article was placed on Fiona Hill for that. And it would seem that Theresa May lost confidence fairly early on, and as a result of which became overly reliant on her advisers, who were policy people. Perhaps Fiona Hill a bit less so, but they were both policy people. As I've said previously on this podcast, the departure of the two main communications people, including Katy Perrier, shortly after the election was even called, perhaps in hindsight showed the trouble that they were in, really. There's been debates over to what extent Linton Crosby was involved in this, whether or not he was in fact not allowed to take a firm grip until the last 2 weeks, by which point it was too late. It's all very peculiar. But actually, to pick up on the point about Toby Young's point about Nick Timothy, there is perhaps his Spectator article, and I first read it because Gabby Hinsliff, the excellent former political editor of The Observer and kind of freelance political commenter, tweeted it. And she said, for her, the key bit in the piece, and this was for me as well, what Nick Timothy was essentially saying was, we're in a situation where it is perhaps unsustainable to expect much, much younger people who have been brought up in different social conditions. And we've talked about this before in terms of, I don't want to be bashing baby boomers all the time, by the way. I don't think that's productive. But I think equally, you know, the housing market, as we talked about earlier, you know, the idea that wages are constantly being, you know, compressed, the fact that we've got increasingly rising inflation, the fact that, you know, the cost of living is far more hostile for much younger people now than it is for older people. It is not realistic to expect the much younger generation to end up bearing what felt like the entirety of the cost of care for a much older generation. And actually, in a way, the young people coming out and voting, I'm glad that they did, because I hope that that wasn't a once in a lifetime event, and that now policymakers are going to have to pitch policy to younger people now as well as older people. And what Nick Timothy was essentially saying was, I was trying to be realistic. I was trying to be honest and say, look, we've got to try and rebalance things, because this is not sustainable and this is not fair, and we cannot continue like this. And in a way, as Gabby Hinsliff said, if, you know, that has been rejected by older people and people have gone, oh, no, 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 I can't possibly have it cost me more money. What are you talking about? In a way, that is rather foreboding for the idea that political parties can be honest with voters. And actually, the way that the Daily Mail tried to spin that part of the manifesto positively for the Conservatives the next day was, they said, at last we have a Prime Minister that's not afraid to be honest with us. And on that day, I thought it would work. I thought, well, that's the way to spin it. And I think that might work, because that's how she was kind of being sort of marketed, as someone that was straightforward. And she trashed her own brand on that by calling an election in the first place, and then you turning on that dementia tax and saying that she hadn't, when in fact she had. But in a way, there's been an anonymous Tory MP or cabinet minister that's been quoted as saying, that's the last time that we're honest with the voters. And I wonder if, you know, as much as I dislike the, you know, the whole Conservative thing that's going on, maybe in a way that is very telling, because of course Labour promised giveaways for everyone, didn't they? And everyone's view, including mine, it has to be said, was, oh well, people would just see through that, weren't they? And they didn't. And the tuition fees was a huge watershed thing in that respect. And yeah, it's you know, like you say, it was ill-advised to structure a whole campaign around someone that, you know, wasn't terribly happy with the spotlight. That was very obvious. But equally, I do have a small shard of sympathy with Nick Timothy for what he says, in the sense of, you know, maybe that this teaches us that being honest doesn't get you anywhere.
It is peculiar, though, that senior politicians who want to, you know, one would assume would be pretty intelligent, self-confident people, they this over-reliance on advisers who cling to them in the manner of a kind of medieval court. And indeed, by the way, Mr. Corbyn would do well to listen less, perhaps, to Seamus Milne, and continue
absolutely.
To react openly and honestly and just be himself. But yeah, Mrs. Her other sidekick, Fiona Hill, and by the way, both this I do find eye-watering, both Fiona Hill and Nick Timothy were earning an eye-watering £140,000 a year. £140,000 a year. And they've each received a £35,000 payoff as well. But Fiona Hill, another example, I think, of power just becoming too much of an aphrodisiac.
Yeah.
I mean, karma was always a step behind, of course. And she overreached herself in getting Michael Gove moved a couple of years ago.
Yes.
And it's widely known, I think, that it was Fiona Hill behind the briefing against Nicky Morgan in that Trousergate business with those awful £1,000 leather
Nicky
trousers.
Nicky Morgan got some fairly forthright text messages as a result of that. And apparently that was very much Fiona Hill's calling card. And a senior civil servant who left was quoted as saying, there are only so many times I'm willing to be called a C-word by an advisor by text message.
Dreadful, isn't it? Absolutely dreadful.
Appalling. I mean, absolutely appalling. These people aren't elected. They have no, you know, their power is given to them by someone else. They are employed to do a job, and, you know, they find themselves, you know, and like you say, they just lose all attachment on reality and their place. And in a way, it shows that Theresa May is a much weaker figure than we all thought perhaps that she might have been, because, you know, again, her reaction, the dreadful reaction to this, the Grenfell Tower, she now, having been strong and stable, is shown as someone that cannot think outside of a script, that seems to have no ability to be fluid in thinking and to be able to even react to events, never mind predict them or prepare for them. If you can't even get your reaction right, then what are you doing?
Exactly. You know, why, if you're again,
and that's why she was so dependent on them, because I think she knew that she couldn't do it and she thought she could get away with it.
Never comfortable in the limelight. I was just looking at that quote again. Theresa, never comfortable in the limelight. Why walk into the limelight then?
Right, absolutely. And there's this odd kind, and I think we talked about this privately before, there's this odd sense of duty that's gone beyond a sense of duty and gone beyond an admirable kind of public, because I think she's very much driven by public service, and it's gone beyond an admirable thing. Again, I talked about her Desert Island Diz last week, and that was the impression that one gets from a few years ago. And it seems to have kind of mutated into this wild kind of idea that it is only her that can be the one to stand at your count when you know that you haven't got a majority nationally on the night/morning of the general election, and tell us that only you can deliver stability. I mean, what the hell? You know, I can't even find words to describe this.
I think, you know, in terms of her being committed to public service, that's fine. But I think she would probably be more comfortable as a
civil servant.
I was just going to say, a junior manager of a housing benefits claims processing section in Maidenhead Town Centre. And that would probably be her level. But somehow, God only knows how, she's gone beyond that and has found herself seemingly terrified by it. And that's a shame. But you're terrified by the position she's in. And that is the most extraordinary thing of all.
And she's now a prisoner as well. This is the weirdest thing.
Prisoner
she's
of her own device. It's exam season. We'll be sitting at our desks and turning over our papers right after the impressions.
People get ready, there's a train a-coming. You don't need no baggage, you just get on board. All you need is faith to hear the dealer's honking. Don't need no ticket, you just thank the Lord. So people get ready for the train to Jordan. Picking up passengers coast to coast. Faith is the key. Open the doors and board 'em. There's hope for all among us love the most.
Ahead of its time in terms of social and political comment from 1964, a Curtis Mayfield
song. I can't believe it's that early. That's ridiculous. I mean, it's someone that has some knowledge of 60s music, and particularly this sort of music. I can't quite believe it was that early, really. Every so often when I'm researching, I do come across a tune like that that's really early, and it does make me raise my eyebrows, and that very much did.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the impressions, and people get ready. It's June, it's the exam season. Over 40 years later, I still get the heebie-jeebies thinking about sitting in some huge hall at a wooden desk, staring at the blue sky beyond and fiddling with a ruler and waiting for some educational goon to say those fateful words, "You may turn over your papers now." And some of you will be thinking, thank God those days are over. Some may even be revising like fury ahead of exams. I know for sure that some of our listeners are parents trying to calm down teenagers who are going through the stress of exams. One of my friends took his daughter out for a walk to try and de-stress her at 1 o'clock in the morning this week.
Goodness
she was so anxious at the impending exam the next day. You've gone through the whole O-level, A-level university degree cycle, Jules. Did you breeze through, or were you chewing the top of your pen in anxiety?
Well, do you know what the weird thing was? I always used to work really, really hard for exams, and maybe I was quite stressed around my GCSEs. And I might have told this story on air before. I don't know if I have, but I'd certainly written about it on the Rocking Vicar website, that actually I had the best ever cure for exam nerves in a really weird way, which was the night before my A-levels, my mum collapsed with a brain hemorrhage and had to be taken away to hospital.
Yes.
And, you know, obviously, it was her. I'm not trying to do down the distress of my mum and my whole family. But the weird thing was, is that I'd done all my work a couple of months beforehand, really, as a result of which everyone said I had this kind of pre-natural calm around me during exams, because I just thought, well, what is the worst that can happen, really? So I balls up this paper about World War II. You know, it's not going to, you know, my mum is possibly dying in hospital. So, you know, maybe this isn't that important. It was too much effing perspective, as Spinal Tap would put it, really. So in a way, after that, I didn't really get that stressed about exams. I mean, to be fair, no, that's not entirely true. I did have an anxiety attack in the middle of my finals at university. But that aside, I didn't get that stressed about exams because I was aware that perhaps they weren't the be-all and end-all. And that's pretty much probably the only thing that could have convinced me that they weren't really an immediate family member nearly kind of keeling over and dying. But anyway, so I was very amused by the fact, and, you know, regular listeners and Terence know that I am basically borderline obsessed with The New Statesman. I think it's the most amazing thing ever. We've got to the point where we seem to share a brain now, me and The New Statesman, because I suggested to Terence earlier this week that we might want to talk about exams, and particularly discussing exams with other people as a topic, because I noticed that one of the psychology A-level papers was trending on Twitter.
Mm.
Which makes a change from, you know, all the usual political crud, doesn't it, really? Mm. But I then clicked on it, and there were various people discussing, what did you put for that question? What did you think of this? Oh, there was a lot of math in that. That wasn't really very fair. And it did make me think that one of the most self-harming rituals of exams ever is when you come out of the exam hall and you know, and everyone starts immediately dissecting the paper. And actually, towards the end of my exams, me and my friend used to have an arrangement whereby if we were in separate exams, one of us would drive round to the side of the sports hall where the university where it took place, and the other person would come out of the side door, usually like Theresa May. Oh, by the way, someone said the other day, someone said Theresa May left the event using a side door, and someone said, "Wow, if ever you wanted an epitaph for a politician, it was that." So someone would leave via a side door, and the person driving the car would open the passenger door seat so that the person could get straight into the car, and we would then drive away before anybody could say anything about what happened in the exam. And because it was different subjects that we weren't doing, we had no means of talking about it at all. And that was actually quite a good approach. The New Statesman read my mind, because a day or two after I noticed this, Amelia Tate wrote a long piece about it, and about the idea of it, and the headline I think is rather sweet: "Cheating, Tweeting and Deleting, How Social Media Revolutionized Exam Season." And her opening paragraph says, "You always had to leave in complete silence. After sitting in a musty, dusty hall for somewhere between an hour and forever, a dinner lady come invigilator would file you out row by row. With your maths/English/additional science GCSE behind you, you would emerge, born again, into the dancing ray of the June sun. You would breathe a sigh of relief, and then it would begin. What did you put for question 7B? Did you mention the Molotov-Ribbentrop pact? What did you get for that one about an ordinary fair dice being rolled 400 times? And she says, students are taking to social media often before their exams to engage in a wide range of activities. There's cheating, there's protesting, and there's plain old complaining. There's joking, there's lamenting, and there's old-fashioned revising. Oh, and there are also tens of begging, pleading tweets from the Department of Education. And this is the oddest story, and I think you will be horrified by this, Terence, as am I, it has to be said. So, a parent tweets the Department for Education and says, this chap's called Matt Thrower, "My 11-year-old missed a #SATS2017 question today because she didn't know M in Roman numerals equals 1,000. Oh, how is that useful information? How is it even maths?" Which I think is a fair question. The response from DFE at EducationGovUK at MattHR: "Hi, please can you remove the tweet referring to SATs? We are trying to maintain the confidentiality and integrity of ongoing tests." Well done, DFE. Are you run by Theresa May by any chance? Because you really have been completely tone deaf. So, yes, I love the fact that social media has brought perhaps pushy/concerned parents a new way in which to bash exam boards, and exam boards and government departments a new way in which to be tone deaf and inflexible.
I really don't recommend anyone follows my oldie world way with exams. I just didn't give a hoot. It's terrible. I'm ashamed of it. I'm fairly sure I've mentioned this story.
Look where you are now, on the greatest, most award-winningest podcast in the galaxy. Yeah.
Exactly. I'm sure I've mentioned this story before, but of course, you know, why would that stop me? And as I said, don't young people don't do what I did. In fact, I'm fairly sure this wouldn't work today anyway, because I believe that, you have coursework taken into account and everything. That didn't happen in my day. Back in the 70s, when I was taking my A-levels, one of my tutors, probably worrying that I might blow one of the other three subjects, suggested around Christmas time that I might want to consider putting myself forward for a fourth A-level. He said it was possible to study history of art over 6 months and still have a good go at getting a decent pass at A-level. Mm. So I said, well, sure, why not? You know, thank you for thinking of that. But then, with the folly of youth, I pushed it to the back of my mind. I was too busy trying to find out what girls were about and listening to Crosby, Stills and Nash.
How are you getting on with that, by the way?
Yeah, not so good. I'm still learning. Yeah. Sometime in May, the exam dates came out, and I found I was entered for the History of Art A-level. And it was a couple of weeks later, and I was too embarrassed to confess that I hadn't bothered studying at all. I had to think of an alternative strategy. So what I did was I popped up to Trafalgar Square. I remember I had a coffee and a croissant at Fortnum and Mason's Cafe. And then I remember going to Trafalgar Square and spent an afternoon just wandering around the National Gallery. And in the same week, I took a library book out on the Renaissance period of art, because I knew that was the syllabus. Yep. It was based on the Renaissance. I turned up for the exam and I just wrote and wrote and wrote. That's one thing I've always been able to do, is just write lots of words. And I used phrases that I'd read in the library book, things like, you know, all the tactile values of sculpture and Botticelli's expressive use of colour and this sort of thing. And I emerged fearing the worst. And then about 6 weeks later, opened the envelope announcing I'd scored an A grade.
For goodness sake.
I mean, it's absolutely absurd. I said, please, young people, don't do that. I was thinking about this, and I did a tiny bit of research this week, and Google tells me that the modern equivalent of the easy A-level pass is inevitably media studies.
Yes, you are talking to someone who has an A star in media studies GCSE, so it was not hugely difficult.
I wondered whether you and hundreds of students would be shouting back at me saying, oh, it's a terribly hard subject to take
on. I mean, the strange thing about media studies was, and actually I'm gonna agree with you on your idea of history of art, that you turn up and you just wrote. So media studies was, when I did it as a GCSE, it was 50% coursework and 50% exam. I really struggled with some aspects of media studies because we had to do various projects that involved presentational skills and art and that sort of thing, visual presentations. And I've always been really bad at art, and partly because I am quite profoundly dyspraxic, so I find that side of things really difficult. And I really struggled on that, and I scraped B's, you know, really did scrape B on some things. And I think an excellent teacher, a really great guy who taught ceramics as well, he said to me, I know from having taught you ceramics that you are not someone that finds physical art very easy. And he, not only did he enormously assist me by selling me his CD copy of OK Computer for £5, like I said, much to like about that man, he managed to help me steer a course through it, because he said, we're going to move on to doing some essay writing now, and I wonder if it might be good for you to put more emphasis on writing essays about things, and then that will help you in the exam. And so we did sport in the media, and we did music, I think, or something else, or drama, that was it. We did half the paper was sport and half the paper was drama. And I realised when we did the mock exam, we had to talk about a performance by Blur on Top of the Pops that we had to sit and watch. Remember all my friends afterwards saying they were very, they laughed because they said we had to watch it three times. Everyone in the room sat and thought, I bet Juliet's really enjoying this. And I really was. But I realised, much like you, that I could just sit and write. And when we had to write about TV drama, I realised, and with TV sports, that I had watched so much. I'd watched so much of these that actually I already knew about them. So in a way, I then had to do a lot of work where I sat and wrote and wrote and wrote and managed to get an A star. And I think perhaps, you know, the relatively low bar of media studies, and, you know, apologies to anyone that's working hard, but this was the case then. This was in 2000. I remember a good friend of mine called Anna, who now works as a sort of a theatrical agent, really making me laugh in sociology AS level, because we were talking about media studies, and she got an A star as well. And she said, that paper, she said, must have been extraordinarily easy, because I thought that I'd messed it up, and not in that kind of, oh, I've messed this up type way. She still managed to get an A star on it, and she said, I must have got pretty much full marks on every question. She wasn't an arrogant person. And I said, how do you know that? And she said, because I ran out of time for the last question, which was about women in sport on TV, I think, or something like that. And she said, the entirety of my answer, my essay answer for the last question on that paper, and there were 9 or 10 questions, I think, she said, I had enough time to write the words Gabby Urath down. And then they said, please, can you put your pens down? So she said, my entire answer to one of the questions was the words Gabby Urath, and that was it. And I still got an A star for that paper.
Amazing.
So it just goes to show on. By the way, talking about the going back to that article, and you know the DfE's, you know, unwielding approach and perhaps roots in Theresa May and the using the same answer to regardless of the question. Someone tweeted, and this is true, hashtag SATs, spelling test yesterday for my daughter, spell course with an A, teacher, very broad Irish accent, didn't specify which course / course with a U, lottery, Department of Education's answer, hi, can you please remove the tweet referring to SATs? Trying to maintain the confidentiality and integrity of the test. And you do think, and also exam papers, and I think there is so much of a kind of a comparison with the government of the day. It's kind of a scale model, really, of this mixture of inflexibility and incompetence at the same time. So the idea that you try to appear efficient, but that is only masking your own incompetence. It says, beyond tricky Roman numerals, there have been a series of well-documented mistakes in this year's secondary school exam papers. The exam board OCR, I remember this being useless even when I was doing them, has issued 3 apologies in 2 weeks for errors in its paper. So in a GCSE English literature question about Romeo and Juliet, the board mistakenly referred to the character Tybalt as a Montague, not a Capulet. Under the hashtag OCR English, students used Twitter to complain in droves. Online petitions calling for grade boundaries to be changed are also incredibly common. We could talk a bit here about how social media has made students into Generation Snowflake when it comes to exams. Although having said that, I remember my teachers complained about the marking of a paper before social media. I don't know. But anyway, exam season, social media perhaps only heightening what was already there? I don't know.
Assuming you're not taking any exams this week, where might your pupils find you?
Yeah, where will I be schooling people on the art of things this week? If I'm not lying in bed on huge amounts of cough medicine, and by the way, apologies that my voice has been extremely, extremely clapped.
Sounds very, very sultry. Sultry is the word.
See, always there for me. So I will be, we're on Sunday now, aren't we? So I'll be doing Indie Wonderland next Wednesday. And that's pretty much it this week. So Indie Wonderland, 8 to 10pm, barricaderadio.com. Quite often themed tunes, sometimes not. Whatever I kind of feel like doing, really. So indie, alt rock and miscellaneous.
And to take us out, a song that goes... It's been
too long since I've taunted you with deeply irritating instrumentals. So, as a treat for us all. I have no shame on this, simply because... I recently reacquired this LP because it was in the box of records that I lost last summer. So I'm delighted to have this back. It's the rather less nice version on the sleeve. The original sleeve had some popcorn on the on it, and this one is just a sort of a gold. Followers of my social media might have seen it on my chair recently. I have not subjected us all to the synth and bagpipe version of Amazing Grace, thankfully. God. Even I think that is horrendous. So it must be pretty bad, even if instrumental chintzy loving me had rejected it. But this song always cheers me up, and we are living in incredibly unstable and uncertain times at the moment. We don't really have a functional government, so in the absence of a functional government, what could bring better cheer than with 70s synth instrumentals? So this is the incredibly underrated Pop's Butter, and this is Popcorn.
You have been listening to a DACM Media production.